Hello and welcome to the Did You Hear podcast, part of KPFA's Area 941 podcast series. On today's show, the debate over whether the Constitution was a pro- or anti-slavery document raged in the early decades of the Republic and eventually culminated in the nation's bloodiest conflict, the American Civil War. The debate was complicated as both pro-slavery forces and some abolitionists took the view that the nation's founding document was irrevocably pro-slavery. But others, including Abraham Lincoln, argued the Constitution was fundamentally at odds with the institution. We'll examine the debate with our guest, historian James Oakes. He's a professor at the City University of New York and author most recently of The Crooked Path to Abolition, Abraham Lincoln and the Anti-Slavery Constitution. The book examines Lincoln's policy of using the Constitution to undermine slavery wherever the federal government held sway, both before, during, and after the American Civil War. I started by asking James Oakes how he came up with the title, The Crooked Path to Abolition.
It comes from the realization that the usual way we talk about emancipation, at least as in terms of the development of federal policy, it's a make a beeline for the Emancipation Proclamation, right? Ask how Lincoln got to it, ask what caused him to get to it. And once you get to it, that's pretty much a straight line from there to the end of slavery. And I learned a long time ago that the story is a lot more complicated, and that's where this title comes from. It took a long time to get to the point where you could imagine the end of slavery, you could imagine it in different ways. And the Emancipation Proclamation is neither the beginning nor the end of the process.
All right, let's talk a little bit about this concept that you speak of in the book of anti-slavery constitutionalism and Abraham Lincoln's relationship to that.
Yeah, I come from a generation that was taught and still believes that the founders at the Constitutional Convention made a series of very important compromises that affected slavery and the relationship of slavery to the Constitution. But generally speaking, that has always been treated as though the word compromise meant anti-slavery people compromising with pro-slavery people. And as I began studying anti-slavery politics 10 or 15 years ago now, it became increasingly clear to me that that's not the way anti-slavery folks saw it, that William Lloyd Garrison's famous denunciation of the Constitution was actually misleading in the sense that probably the majority of abolitionists didn't agree with that, and certainly all slaveholding politicians thought that the Constitution was primarily a document of freedom. So I had to go back and ask, where did they get this idea from? And it occurred to me that when we talk about the compromises over slavery at the Constitutional Convention, we also have to realize that the slaveholders were forced to compromise with the anti-slavery people, just as the anti-slavery people compromised with pro-slavery people. And what you got was a Constitution that could be read in different ways and was read in very different ways by the supporters and opponents of slavery. And the book traces that process out by which these pro-slavery and anti-slavery interpretations of the Constitution developed, and to the point where what Lincoln inherited when he entered politics, and in particularly when he became an anti-slavery politician, which didn't happen until 1854, he inherits this long tradition of anti-slavery constitutionalism that you need to understand that first to understand his politics, but also going back to your original question, to understand how he and the Republican Party treated slavery and the problem of emancipation once you get into the Civil War.
Lincoln himself had strong anti-slavery sentiments within, even though you mentioned in the book that he's not an abolitionist in the traditional sense. He's
right.
Still very much opposed to slavery on moral grounds. Where does that come from? Has that come from early in his life or earliest career as a politician?
Yeah, I think we should just take him at his word. He says late in the 1850s that he can't remember a time when he didn't feel hostile to slavery. He grew up in an anti-slavery family. His parents joined an anti-slavery church. So I think he just inherited that view from his youth. It still had to become a complex political view with complex understandings of what the Constitution did or did not allow. But still, I think he always hated.
Do we know if there was any particular instances in his life where he saw the brutality of it or the inhumanity of it close up?
Well, there are stories of a couple of trips he took down on flatboats down the Mississippi River as a young man, in which he claimed later on to be horrified by the shackling of slaves and the treatment of slaves on board and in New Orleans when he ended up. It's very difficult to know what to do about those stories, because virtually everything we know about Abraham Lincoln's childhood and youth come from recollections after the Civil War, sometimes many years after the Civil War. But there are those stories, and he does himself say that he recollects seeing these things, and that in a letter to his best friend Joshua Speed, he says at one point, you complain about these anti-slavery folks, but you know, we see these things and we bite our lips because we're committed to saving the Union, and we hold our tongues in how much we're willing to say. So he does say that some of these things about slavery for man.
Let's talk a little bit about the sort of the intellectual debates of that time. You mentioned it a little earlier in remarks, but I guess there was a lot of argument going back and forth using the Constitution, both pro and anti-slavery, right?
Yes, exactly. And this is what I hope will be the big takeaway from my book, that rather than thinking of the Constitution as just a pro-slavery document, we think of it as a document that pro-slavery and anti-slavery people fought over tremendously, bitterly for decades and evolved into very complex arguments. So, for example, everyone knows about the Dred Scott decision and the terrible decision written by Chief Justice Roger Taney, which in many ways is a distillation of the pro-slavery constitutional argument. But there were two dissenting justices on the court, and they published their own opinions, which are in many ways distillations of the anti-slavery constitutional position. And one of the things you see developing over time is anti-slavery people invoking more and more of clauses of the Constitution to their benefit. They'll quote the preamble, promises, to the purpose of the government to preserve the liberty of all people. That's an anti-slavery clause. One of the places you really see fighting over it is the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment says that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, for the slaveholders, that's a pro-slavery clause, because slaves are property and the Constitution protects property that way. But for anti-slavery people, that's an anti-slavery clause, because it says you can't be deprived of your liberty without due process of law. It says no person shall be deprived of liberty without due process of law. And the Constitution famously only refers to slaves as persons, even in the Fugitive Slave Clause. The fact that the Constitution only refers to slaves as persons has often been taken to be like a euphemism. The founders sort of didn't want to mention it because they were embarrassed by it. Recent scholarship suggests that there's much more to it than that, that the slaveholders at the Constitutional Convention tried very hard to get a right of property into the Constitution and were denied. They failed. And we have debates over that in the Constitutional Convention. And so the fact that slaves are referred to as persons becomes extremely important for understanding the Constitution as an anti-slavery document. It means that all the rights of personhood apply to any Black person once they step outside the legal boundaries of a state that legalizes slavery, right? Where if the law says you're property, but outside of a slave state, you're not property. The Constitution only recognizes a fugitive slave as a person. The Constitution only recognizes a slave carried into the Western territories as a person, or on the high seas as a person. And this becomes the basis for anti-slavery constitutionalism, just as the right of property becomes the basis for pro-slavery.
Now, as a member of Congress, did Lincoln sponsor any particular anti-slavery legislation?
Yeah, he drafted a bill to abolish slavery in Washington, D.C. He had first commented, in fact, the first comment he ever makes publicly about slavery came when he was in the Illinois legislature a decade, more than a decade earlier, when he rejected a resolution by the Illinois legislature that seemed to be designed to mollify the slaveholders. They were responding to petitions from abolitionists calling for the abolition of slavery in Washington, D.C., and Lincoln issued a public statement saying that Congress can, under the Constitution, abolish slavery in Washington, D.C., and says that slavery is both unjust and bad policy. So 10 years, 15 years later, when he goes to Congress, he actually drafts a bill to abolish slavery in the Columbia. And as you know, when he was president, he signed such a bill in the Republic. So the first, he does actually draft anti-slavery legislation. He's also, while he's in Congress, is the huge debate over the disposition of territories recently snatched from Mexico in the war against Mexico. Anti-slavery, the Northerners want slavery excluded from that territory, and the Southerners demand the right to bring their slaves with them into the territories, and Lincoln votes at least half a dozen times to ban slavery from all the Western territories. So he didn't sponsor the legislation, but he voted in favor of a complete ban.
Now, as president, Lincoln differed with some of the major abolitionist figures on this constitutional issue, particularly the newspaper publisher William Lloyd Garrison, who viewed the Constitution as a very pro-slavery, even to the point of, symbolically burning it.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the differences there.
Well, I think the differences go in both directions. That is, Garrison represents one wing, a radical wing that sees, as you say, he sees the Constitution as a hopelessly pro-slavery document. But at the other end of the spectrum of abolitionist thought were people like Frederick Douglass, for example, who had come to the conclusion that the Constitution was an abolitionist doctrine. So he tended to criticize Lincoln for not going far enough, fast enough on the question of anti-slavery, because he had come to the conclusion that the Constitution empowered the federal government to do much more than Lincoln believed. The spectrum of constitutional thought among anti-slavery people went, it wasn't just Garrison. It was Garrison at one end and anti-slavery or abolitionist constitutionalist at the other end. And Lincoln is, battered by both sides. Actually, I shouldn't say that. Garrison comes around during the war to a respect for Lincoln and a respect for how much Lincoln manages to do in the context of war. There is a kind of loophole that anti-slavery people see in the Constitution that has to do with war powers. So all of those pro-slavery aspects of the Constitution are to some extent tossed out the window if there's a war, because suddenly war powers come into play and they do allow the federal government in the context of war to confiscate enemy property. The slaves are legally defined as movable property and therefore they can be confiscated. And once confiscated, the logical of the law is, we've confiscated this property, but we don't want to hold slaves as property. We don't believe they should be property. So we're just going to emancipate them. And the laws of war allow us to do that. So in a sense, Garrison's pro-slavery constitutionalism is mooted by the fact of war. By the end of the war, he's very, very complimentary, as is Frederick Douglass.
And how about the Fugitive Slave Clause portion of the Constitution? Was that a particularly thorny issue for the anti-slavery constitutionalists?
Yeah, there were two clauses in the Constitution that the anti-slavery people don't like. One of them is the notorious three-fifths clause, which allows the slave states to count three-fifths of their slave population representation. Gives them extra influence in the House of Representatives and in the Electoral College. The other one is the Fugitive Slave Clause, which gives the slaveholders the right of recaption in northern states. But early on, northern states read the Fugitive Slave Clause as something that is to be enforced by the states, and the states have the right to guarantee the due process rights of accused fugitives, which the slaveholders don't want to do. You can't property doesn't have due process rights for them. And so there's tension in the way the Fugitive Slave Clause is interpreted by Northern and Southern states right from the 1780s onward. And it becomes a major issue in the 1850s after the Southerners managed to secure a much more draconian fugitive slave law in 1850 over the opposition of the overwhelming majority of Northerners. And that leads to a fugitive slave crisis. And this is something I think historians are only just beginning to realize is a second major factor in the coming of the Civil War. We've known a long time that the Civil War is over expansion of slavery into the territories, but I think we've underestimated the degree to which conflict over the meaning of the Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution also played a role. And Lincoln actually says this in his inaugural address. He says, look, there's a difference of opinion about what the Fugitive Slave Clause means, whether the states should enforce it or the federal government should enforce it. But I think that in any law upon the subject, the due process rights of guaranteed by the Constitution should be respected. That's effectively taking the anti-slavery constitutional position and suggesting a federal law guaranteeing due process rights, which is anathema to the slaveholders.
Now, the Fugitive Slave Clause and then the later Fugitive Slave Act leads to instances where freed African Americans are sometimes kidnapped and sold into slavery, and you have the Solomon Northrop story,
yes,
among others. Did they have any federal recourse? Could they sue in federal court?
By the 1850s, most of those suits, I'm a little bit out of my league here, most of those suits, I think, take place in state courts, and in southern courts, they're likely to rule in favor of the slaveholder, and in northern courts, they're likely to rule in favor of the anti-slavery folks, the accused fugitive. This is, in fact, part of the disagreement over the Fugitive Slave Clause, whether or not it's enforceable by the state or enforceable by the federal government. And there's disagreement among anti-slavery folks, right? People like Lincoln, who come out of a Whig tradition that supports strong federal government, will say, look, there's a Fugitive Slave Clause in the Constitution that implies that the federal government should be the enforcement agent. But if it's going to be the enforcement agent, it should have the power to guarantee due process rights. Whereas someone like Salmon P. Chase, who's an anti-slavery radical, comes out of a Jacksonian Democratic tradition, will say, there's no enforcement clause in the Fugitive Slave Clause, therefore the Constitution presumes that only the state should enforce it. It's difficult to say how a federal court would rule because there's disagreement among Northerners over what kind of power federal government versus has had.
And we're speaking with James Oakes. He's a history professor at the City University of New York and author most recently of Crooked Path to Abolition, Abraham Lincoln and the Anti-Slavery Constitution. James, I want to get your take on Lincoln's relationship with some of the key African-American leaders of the era. You were talking about his relationship with Frederick Douglass. Would you say that it was a relationship of mutual respect, or do you more antagonistic? Well, how would you characterize it?
Well, in the case of Frederick Douglass, to pick up on a point I was making earlier, he comes into the Civil War believing that the federal government had much more power than Lincoln and most Republicans believed he had to attack slavery directly. And so he's skeptical. He's skeptical because Lincoln has said things about racial equality that were disturbing to Douglass and disturbing to us today. So he was not sure that Lincoln was going to be as aggressively anti-slavery as he could. But nevertheless, he had moved very far from the Garrisonian position, which he had taken in the 1840s, and had come to view the victory of the Republicans as the victory of anti-slavery. So he was hopeful and at the same time skeptical. And then beginning in the summer of 1863, he starts to meet with Lincoln. He has three meetings with Lincoln, and the first one in the summer of 1863, when he is concerned about the fact that Black slaves black troops are being abused by Confederates, and he wants Lincoln to issue an order of retaliation. He comes to Washington and he meets Lincoln, and he comes away impressed by the depth of Lincoln's hostility to slavery, but still a bit skeptical. He meets with Lincoln again in the summer of 1864, when Lincoln calls him to the White House and says, look, I'm afraid I'm going to lose this election and emancipation's going to stop, and I need some help. I would like a cadre of free blacks to go into the South and encourage slaves to take advantage of the Emancipation Proclamation, as many as possible. And he comes away from that meeting convinced, utterly convinced, that Lincoln is sincerely and powerfully anti-slavery. And as a result, he returns to Washington to see Lincoln for the third time at his inaugural address, and meets Lincoln at the reception afterwards. Lincoln greets him loudly and as my friend Frederick Douglass. So I think the relationship grows over time. And I suspect that that's true as more generally of African-Americans who met with Lincoln over the course of the war. And he met with several major leading African-Americans during that war. And the more hostile he became to slavery, the more aggressively his administration pushed anti-slavery measures, obviously the more appreciative African-Americans were of his stance. And by the end of the war, African-Americans are overwhelmingly supportive of Lincoln. There's a very nice book by a colleague, Martha Hodes, on the way Lincoln's death was greeted in various parts of the country. And she makes it very clear that Lincoln's assassination was deeply and widely mourned in the African-American community.
Now, Douglass, is it safe to say that he heavily pushed for the Lincoln to recruit African-Americans for the Union Army, right?
Yes, he was pushing for that right at the beginning of the war. He made an argument that Lincoln would not make, eventually make, until 1863, which is that if you're not going to enlist African-Americans, you're fighting the war with one hand behind your back. They're going to be the most committed this war, they're going to be the most committed to Union victory and the most committed to destroying the Confederacy. So he's pushing for that intensely. The law itself, in the 1860s, up from the Revolution to the Civil War, Union soldiers are recruited through state militias. And the Militia Act of the 1790s banned blacks from militias. So Lincoln's hands are to some extent tied until July of 1862, when Congress removes the word white requirement for militia. And then you start seeing experiments that Lincoln allows in recruiting black troops. Finally, with the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln comes fully around to recruiting black military service. But, you know, in the intervening period, people like Frederick Douglass, and not just Frederick Douglass, generally speaking, radicals are pushing for a more aggressive recruitment of blacks into the Union.
And just on the legislative front, would you say that the radical Republicans, the Thaddeus Stevenses and Sumners, did you think that they had a, even though they wanted Lincoln to do a lot more towards the emancipation issue, do you think that they had a good sort of symbiotic relationship, or do you think there's sometimes when they were stepped on each other?
Oh, you know, for the most part, I think the relationship was symbiotic. Yeah, I think it's important to understand. I mean, this is going to sound like an unflattering comparison, but to some extent, the radicals in the Republican Party during the Civil War are rather like the Tea Party in the Republican Party today. That is, they're the base, and they're very aggressive, and they take the lead in pushing Republican policy toward a more radical position, and they succeed. You know, Thaddeus Stevens is effectively the whip in the House from the beginning of the war, and you know, people like Stephen, not Stephen Douglas, people like Charles Sumner, was on very friendly terms with Lincoln. Owen Lovejoy was one of Lincoln's staunchest defenders, and he was a leading radical. And Henry Wilson, another radical, defended Lincoln. So I think it's a mistake to see the relationship between Lincoln and the radicals as one of pure hostility. I think it's important to understand the degree to which they are all operating within a fairly similar set of understandings of what the Constitution did and did not allow with regard to slavery. So you're never going to hear a radical say, Congress should just pass a law abolishing slavery in the states, because they all agreed that Congress didn't have that power under the Constitution. They had to get at it in other ways, through military emancipation. And ultimately, the only solution was the constitutional amendment. So I think it is certainly true that you can hear Lincoln griping about the complaints of radicals, but you can also hear him say to abolitionists, look, you guys, I have the whole North that I have to be responsive to, and not everybody's in favor of aggressive emancipation policies. So why don't you guys go out there and attack me and whip up public sentiment in favor of emancipation so it makes my life easier? You know, we have tapes of Lyndon Johnson talking to Martin Luther King in exactly the same way, saying, look, I need to convince some of these, my fellow Southerners, to support the Civil Rights Act. So you go out there and build some public pressure on me, and that makes it easier for me. Lincoln said almost exactly the same kind of thing to abolitionists like Phillips and Moncure Conway. So I think in that sense, the word you used is correct. It's more of a symbiotic relationship.
I'm going to take you a little bit outside of the scope of the book here. I'm going to have you put your film critics hat on for a minute. The film, the Spielberg film Lincoln, a few years back, we had some brilliant performances in it. You know, particularly Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln,
right,
and Tommy Lee Jones as Thaddeus Stevens. The historical accuracy on some of those debates and things. What's your take on that?
Well, I think when I attribute that script to Tony Kushner, who is a very smart guy and did a lot of research. And I think it was, as a historian, I was pleased to see someone bring the debate over slavery, and in this case, the Constitutional Amendment, right into the halls of Congress, because that's where the big debate took place. And he gets that accurate for the most part. They push a little beyond the fact when they have Lincoln openly supporting, bribing congressmen to vote in favor of the anti-slavery amendment. There's really no evidence of that. He's got Seward, who was the Secretary of State in Washington, D.C., doing that, but he was actually up in New York pressing lame duck congressmen, Democrats, to do that. And again, there's some complaints that he was using bribery, but no actual evidence. And, you know, the Tommy Lee Jones character, the Thaddeus Stevens character, he ultimately comes around, there's a scene, if you recall, at the end of the film, there's a scene where he's in bed with his African-American housekeeper. He shows her the 13th Amendment. The unfortunate implication of that scene is that he did that for personal reasons. But I think that's a bit misleading.
Well, let's take a little bit of a look at Lincoln's support for the colonization movement. I guess we should first describe what that is and how this played into his abolitionist sentiments.
Colonization is not a one-size-fits-all thing. Thomas Jefferson is talking about it already in his notes on the state of Virginia in the 1780s. But as a serious political movement, it emerges right after the War of 1812. In the formation of the American Colonization Society, and almost immediately a split develops between the northern wing of the movement and the southern wing. And I should say, almost all of this is located in either the lower north that borders on the south, or the upper south that is on the north. That's where the strongest support for it comes from. But northerners who support colonization do so as one of the means by which slavery would be abolished ultimately. If the government subsidizes the voluntary colonization of freed people outside the United States, it would lead more rapidly to the ultimate extinction of slavery, that's what we should do. But for many Southerners who support colonization, it's about ridding the slave states of the obnoxious presence, dangerous Blacks. So Lincoln comes out of that lower North tradition. He views colonization as a mechanism for convincing skeptical Northerners that emancipation will not bring large numbers of free Blacks into the Northern states. Many of those states, especially where he grew up, had deeply racist statutes that discriminated against free Blacks in a variety of ways. So part of it is appealing to that. Part of it is it's something that will encourage states to abolish slavery on their own. So he is a supporter of the federal subsidies for the voluntary colonization of slaves somewhere outside the United States from 1852 to 1862, a vocal supporter of that. Whether or not it's widely assumed that when you say colonizationist, it means racist, but I attribute it more to Lincoln's racial, what I call Lincoln's racial pessimism. He didn't think whites would ever allow Blacks to live as equals, full equals in the United States. So he imagined that they would be better off if they could find a place to go, maybe in Central America or in the Caribbean, where they would be treated as full equals and entitled to the enjoyment of all their rights. So he's very pessimistic. Until he issues the Emancipation Proclamation, then he stops talking about it and begins working in the opposite direction. Ends his life advocating even voting rights.
Tell me a little bit about James Oakes, about the role that the Civil War itself played in, as sort of an accelerant to the abolitionist movement or the movement to end slavery. Do you think it would have taken maybe decades longer without the Civil War to end slavery?
Yes. I mean, there are disagreements among historians about what would have happened had the war not taken place. So it's hard for me to imagine that slavery would have been abolished in any reasonable amount of time, or would have taken generations. So I think that there are two ways of thinking about the relationship between anti-slavery politics, anti-slavery, and the war. You could say it wouldn't have done anything had there not been a war. It was basically a toothless form of attack on slavery, given the fact that everybody agreed that Congress had no power to direct the policy in the state. They'd have to go through it indirectly in all these other ways. Or you could say wars don't lead to the abolition of slavery automatically. Throughout human history, war is the single greatest source of slaves. Armies generally enslaved people in large numbers. And Civil War is different because the people in control of the army were anti-slavery. So the army is required to enforce anti-slavery policies rather than pro-slavery policies. So it's hard to imagine the war leading to the abolition of slavery without the presuppositions of anti-slavery constitutionalism and the going into the war. And the war, the longer the war lasts, the more anti-slavery politics became radicalized by the war. You start with freeing the slaves who run into Union lines in small numbers. The numbers grow. You issue an Emancipation Proclamation. You change the militia law. You do all these things. You make it a crime for anyone in the Union Army to abolish slaves, to send slaves back. So there's a building process of radicalization, and the Emancipation Proclamation is in some ways a culmination of that. But it also alters the policy in the sense that it gives teeth to the longstanding anti-slavery policy, which designed to use the federal government to pressure slavery on their own. Now they have this, in addition to carrots of subsidized colonization, compensation, gradual timetable, now you have this big stick of military emancipation, massive military emancipation that you can wield against the state and say, look, get rid of slavery on your own right now, or you're going to have this way or that way. So you start to see a further radicalization even after, again, culminating in an amendment that abolishes. The war radicalizes an anti-slavery politics
And that is the voice of James Oakes. He's professor of history at the City University of New York and author, most recently, of Crooked Path to Abolition, Abraham Lincoln, and the Anti-Slavery Constitution. And James has been good enough to join us today. James, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And that's it for this episode of Did You Hear? I'm Max Pringle. Did You Hear is part of KPFA's Area 941 podcast series and can be found at kpfa.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.